Starbuck. I didn't need correcting.
Shut up!
Order!
Order! Let's start off as we need to go on.
We can see a better future.
So it's not a competition who can shout the loudest.
Hello, I'm Kathleen, and you're listening to the Left Wingers podcast. We are an unashamedly left-wing podcast made by activists for activists. Welcome to another episode of Whinging Wednesday. We'll be giving you our hot takes on the week's stories, playing games, and responding to what you, our listeners, have to say.
For today's Whinging Wednesday episode, we're going to be joined by Lord Daniel Moylan, a Conservative peer in the House of Lords, yet a little bit different to what we're normally doing at this time on a Wednesday. Having responded to his response to the Yorkshire Post article about levelling up, we thought it was fair when he called for it to invite him on the podcast so that he could explain his perspective and what we discussed in the last episode.
So thank you so much for joining today, and thank you for making time to speak to us. We do appreciate it.
I suggested it.
Absolutely.
I invited myself on. I thought if you're going to talk about me, you might let me get a word in myself.
I think that's completely fair. Okay, so we have to start at the beginning. You are the first Lord that we've ever had on this show. And I think people listening might be a little bit confused as to what a day in the life looks like for you and what you get up to being a Lord.
Well, what it looks like for me might be different from what it looks like for other members of the House of Lords, because there are nearly 800 of us altogether. But quite a lot of those never appear. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have people like me who do it more or less full time. And I will do it full time for a few years until I gradually fail and sort of get weak and febrile and can't manage to get quite so involved. And it's full of late nights and things like that. And basically, it sounds like a great place to have a political platform and campaign and things like that, and some people manage that, but most of the people who are working in the House of Lords, the peers, the members who are working in the House of Lords, are actually working on legislation, because the House of Lords, like the House of Commons, is what it says on the can. It is a legislature, and of course we don't really get much say in what the bills are that we are being presented with to scrutinize, because most of the legislative agenda is controlled by the government. So you have bills coming through that have been chosen by the government. Sometimes they've been through the Commons already. Sometimes they start in the House of Lords and have to go through the Commons later. And a large part of what peers do, and this is all parties, is the way it works in the House of Lords is it discussion proceeds by way of amendments. So you have the bill that's presented by the government, and then you put down amendments, and that initiates a debate. In the Commons, the Speaker chooses which amendments are debated. But in the Lords, we don't really have a Speaker. We have a Lord Speaker, but they really just chair meetings. They don't have great decision-making powers. So all of the amendments are debated, and with a view either to changing the legislation or to getting some sort of concession from the government on something. And because the government doesn't have a majority in the House of Lords, many of those amendments are passed and then have to be taken out by the Commons again, because obviously it has to be, the final product has to be agreed by both houses. So they ding-dong, it's called ping-pong, at the end to try and get an agreed text, with the Lords usually giving way because we're not the elected House. But we are scrutinising the legislation and very often improving it.
What are you most proud of in terms of your work as a Lord, or anything that you've done in the past, you know, 1 or 2 years that you're particularly happy about?
In terms of legislation, I got 2 tiny concessions out of government on the Police and Crime Bill. The first one was ever so tiny, but it related to an intractable problem to do with prisoners who are known as IPP prisoners. So back in about 2002, David Blunkett, when he was Home Secretary, introduced this new type of prison sentence where you'd never be let out unless you become a reformed character for people who'd committed crimes of violence. And it's totally unjust. And it was abolished a few years later as being unjust and really incompatible with people's human rights. But the people who've been sent to jail in the interim, many of them are still in jail for offences that they would have served maybe 4 years for, and they're still there 20 years later in some cases. And even if they get out on license, they can't have the license cancelled for 10 years. They have to keep their nose clean for 10 years. So if they do something even quite small, something, you know, you and I might get a slap on the wrist for, they can be yanked back into jail and for the rest of their lives. It's completely unjust. And to be fair, the person who is leading the campaign to reform it all is actually David Blunkett, to his credit. So he recognises the whole thing is absolutely not what was intended in the first place and has led to some very unjust outcomes. So there are still about 3,000 people in jail on these sentences. And I did get the government to give just a very small concession about how they would treat people who are on licence and improve treatment for them, the ones who are out. We had a much bigger programme. What David Blunkett and I and Igor Judge, who's a former Lord Chief Justice who sits on the crossbenches, and various other peers are working on this to get more from the government. But basically, in the Commons, there are no votes for anything to do with violent prisoners. So it's extremely difficult. But we did get one small concession. And in the same bill, I got the government to agree that the guidance under which police forces operate when they're dealing with non-crime hate incidents, that guidance is issued by the College of Policing. Nobody knows what the College of Policing is. And there's no parliamentary supervision of the guidance produced by the College of Policing. So they agreed to change the law so that is, this was my amendment, that is now going to be brought under the control of the Home Secretary. So the guidance will be statutory guidance and Parliament will be able to scrutinise it and she'll be able to be held accountable for it. So those are the only two things I think I've achieved in the 18 months I've been here. But that's actually quite a lot in some ways, because being in the House of Lords is, you know, it's not about great victories. It's about just tiny, tiny successes, if you want to get anything changed.
So as a Conservative peer appointed by Boris Johnson, how do you think he's doing as Prime Minister? Do you think his last 18 months have been as much of a success potentially as yours?
Brilliantly. He's doing brilliantly. Yes and no is the answer to Boris's time as Prime Minister, because what nobody expected, least of all him, was that you were going to have this global pandemic. And I think people will look back and say that he handled it quite well. So on the one hand, you had the drive to close everything down, which could be taken to extremes, as it was in, I think it's fair to say, in places like New Zealand and so forth, maybe to some extent in Australia. And on the other, you had the, oh, it's just the flu, take no notice, carry on sort of approach, which you saw in Brazil and to some extent in some of the American states and so on. And I think Boris's instincts would be, you know, to not to lock down as fully as was done. But he, I think he balanced that as well as probably anybody could. The National Health Service did not collapse under the strain in the first few months, which it certainly could have done. And we saw that in northern Italy, especially and even before the virus landed in the UK. And people more or less got through it without too much pain. I mean, there were excess deaths. And the question is, were the excess deaths greater or less than you would have expected in the context next to a global pandemic? Not were there excess deaths, because inevitably there would be. So I think people look back kindly on that. And of course, it obviously was a huge distraction from his domestic agenda. And what he has to do now is try and reset that domestic agenda on a different electoral cycle, and recognizing, of course, that he's been damaged by the whole series of onslaughts against him, one of which is the Partygate thing. And he's got to re-establish his authority in the light of that.
So I think one of the things that we're really happy to have you on to talk about is this, because you have a good or a better connection than, you know, me or Brandon or anyone listening. Do you speak to Team Boris a lot? How do you think they're feeling? You know, we've had many chats on the podcast. We've said, you know, the letters are going to go in next week, this week, which, you know, do you think that that's even likely? What do the next, in your opinion, what do the next 6 months look like for Boris Johnson?
Well, I worked for Boris closely for nearly 8 years, but I I'm not constantly texting him, and I don't know a lot about what Team Boris thinks, so I can't give you the hotline to what's being thought of at the heart of Number 10, I'm afraid. My personal view is that I think, first of all, there's quite a high chance that he won't get a fine at all. And secondly, if he does, I don't think there'll be a huge movement to get rid of him. There's a group of people on the Conservative backbenches in the Commons who never wanted Boris, have always hated Boris. Many of them are Remainers. They've always hated Brexit. They're miserable old sods. I mean, Sir Roger Gale is a prime example of a miserable old sod of whom nobody would have heard if he didn't hate Boris. And that's his sole claim to fame, that he hates Boris. He's always hated Boris. He has a long track record of hating Boris. It's not new. And that's all you ever need to know about Sir Roger Gale. So there's sort of people like that. But I don't think there'll be enough to dislodge him. And I think the fact that he's still an election winner and he is still, you know, and other things are happening, like a potential war with Russia and things like that. But I just don't think, you know, he's going to be forced out. That's my personal view.
And it's interesting to hear about you working with him for so long. Did you enjoy working with Boris Johnson? Was he a good person to work with, or was he at times, as we've maybe heard from people, quite challenging to work with?
Well, he's demanding to work for. I mean, people say, you know, people sort of imagine working for Boris is all you do is sit round in his office, you know, slapping your thighs and roaring with laughter because it's just one joke after another. And it's not like that at all. He was very, very focused on the delivery of his manifesto. He, you know, had charts and chased people up about why such and such wasn't happening. If you couldn't give a reasonable explanation of why it wasn't happening, he doesn't get cross. He's not a sort of cross-shouty person. He's more sort of, you know, sort of, but you know he's unhappy, put it that way. When he's unhappy, you know he's unhappy, but he's not a shouty person. He doesn't like sort of confrontation and anger and things like that. And so you just have to go away and try harder or do better, really. And so he's quite demanding. And people who say he's lazy and he doesn't do detail is completely wrong. He's perfectly capable of doing detail on things that he's interested in. And he works extremely hard. He's a very early riser. He does an awful lot of his work around 6 o'clock in the morning. Boris's day, you want to hear about my day, but when he was mayor, Boris's day would start around about 5 or 6. You could sort of see that from messages. And then he'd work and he'd do his reading and his writing then. About 9:30, he'd get on his bike and he'd be in City Hall about 10 o'clock in his office, if he wasn't going off somewhere else to a meeting. And he'd be in City Hall in his office. And then from 10 o'clock onwards, it would just be one meeting after another. There was no chance to do any reading or writing. So he'd just carry on like that. And then he'd try to get a nap for half an hour in the afternoon on the sofa in his office. And his staff used to try and protect half an hour for him to have a nap. And that gave him a little bit of more energy to go on into the early evening. But he's not a late night person at all. He wants, you know, he's not a late night person. He's not somebody you'd find out like Michael Gove in a nightclub at 3 or 4 in the morning, sort of driving away. That's not Boris's normal style. There'd have to be a very special reason for that if he was ever to do it.
As you said earlier in the podcast, you've asked to be invited onto the podcast to talk to us about the Yorkshire Post article, and we thought it was very fair to have you on. So would you like to explain why you responded to the article by the Yorkshire Post, which was talking about the government's levelling up plans, particularly in rural North Yorkshire, saying everything I've read recently in the Yorkshire Post makes me fear I'm going to find it, I'm assuming referring to Yorkshire, transformed into a county of leftist whingers begging for handouts. Why did you feel the need to post that when you did?
I had no idea when I posted that that there was actually an organisation called Lefty Whingers. in your case, Brandon, based in Yorkshire. So obviously I was on to something. I wasn't particularly responding to that article because, as the tweet said, it was sort of everything I've seen, really, is that the Yorkshire Post just bangs on moaning miserably the whole time. And that's all I was saying. I was going up. I did go up for a week in Yorkshire. And I was my point was to say that I think they're misportraying Yorkshire people as leftist whingers. I think it's pretty clear if you read the tweet that that's what it actually says, and that they were misportraying Yorkshire people in that sense. So I didn't really expect that the editor of the Yorkshire Post was going to be quite as thin-skinned as he turned out to be. And obviously, he is a bit of a lefty whinger. I'm surprised. Maybe he works with you from time to time because he's probably under your banner. Not only was he on Twitter sort of thrashing away, but the next thing I know, something appears in the Daily Mail. I'm sure he's got friends in the press. Whether he was behind that or not, I don't know. Then there's an article in the Yorkshire Post, which I haven't read because I'd have to spend 50 pence to get behind the paywall. And I'd rather die than spend 50 pence on the Yorkshire Post after the way he's gone on. And then he sent one tweet in which he basically said something like, an attack on me and my team is an attack on Yorkshire, which I think shows a level of megalomania that is sort of bizarre. I mean, if you imagine the editor of the Daily Mail saying an attack on me is an attack on England, we'd all fall about laughing. So he decided to carry on and just make a lot of fuss about it. But I wasn't going to give in to the bullying. I know what he wanted. You know, he just wanted to silence somebody who had criticized him. Well, nobody's entitled to do that. And he's got a newspaper, and friends, no doubt, in other newspapers on his side. All I've got is Twitter and my 8,000 or 9,000 followers. That's me. That's all I've got. So that's what I was going to do. I was going to carry on responding to him and putting him down and disagreeing with him. So that's how it sort of developed. Anyway, it added something to the holiday, although probably, in the end, it would have been a nicer holiday if I hadn't had to deal with him the whole time. But all the people I met in Yorkshire were absolutely fantastic, of course, as they always are. And it was good to see lots of Yorkshire people on Twitter saying, we agree with you and we don't like the Yorkshire Post, he's ruined.
So what I would kind of say back to that is, obviously, you're saying that the opinions expressed in the Yorkshire Post are the opinions of one person. But is a regional newspaper like the Yorkshire Post, like, for example, the Manchester Evening News, are they as papers expressing kind of the interests of some of their readers, concerns over the failure to address rural communities in the levelling up plans? Are they unfounded in that? Is that not something which they're right to be concerned about?
I think it's absolutely their job to give a local voice. And what I really objected to in the response of the editor of the Yorkshire Post to my tweet was not that he disagreed with me, because after all, it's his newspaper and I'm attacking it. Of course, he's entitled to disagree with me. What I really resented was that he tried to misrepresent what I'd said as saying something rude about people of Yorkshire. And that's what all the fans who came out, the anonymous bots who came out on Twitter, were doing. They were saying, I'd been rude about the people of Yorkshire and accused them all of being leftist whingers. Whereas, in fact, of course, my tweet was in exactly the opposite sense. Rather saying that he and his newspaper were increasingly representing them as if they were, and so on. And it was that misrepresentation of me that really was the reason I kept it going. If he just said, you know, we don't agree with Lord Moylan and he's a bit of an idiot and a complete plonker, that'd be perfectly all right. People say that all the time. And why shouldn't they? But it was misrepresenting me that I thought was that. I can't allow him to get away with that. That's not fair.
Because the article was so specific to North Yorkshire and rural seats, and knowing the political geography of North Yorkshire, it's incredibly blue, and it's incredibly, apart from at York Central, it's incredibly a conservative region of the country. Would it be fair to say that potentially, even indirectly labelling voters in those areas showing concerns about levelling up and development, calling them left-wingers, might turn off potential conservative voters who have otherwise been loyal to the party? Because obviously, as you will have found out, there's quite a lot of a strong regional identity there.
I don't think anybody, when they come to cast their vote at the next general election, is going to be influenced or even remember what some random member of the House of Lords said in a Twitter spat with the editor of the Yorkshire Post. But as my tweet made clear, it wasn't specific to that article. It said, it began, I think, from all I've read recently in the Yorkshire Post, not that particular article, but a general impression. And I found lots of people in Yorkshire on Twitter who have been saying they agree with me about that, that basically they don't like what he's done with the newspaper over the last 5 or 6 years.
I mean, I think you've made your points quite clear. I'd love to ask, do you think that Boris, do you think that he is enacting his levelling up agenda in places like Yorkshire? Because obviously, as Brandon was saying, a lot of Conservative seats, a lot of Conservative voters. Do you think that Boris is going to help them in the next 2 or 3 years with his agenda?
Well, I think the first thing to grasp, and the really important thing to grasp, is that it's this Conservative government is the first government in years, really since the 1960s, who are trying to have an industrial policy for the regions. I don't mean the very fringe regions, the sort of really remote places. Think back to our days in the European Union, long time ago now. In those days, the amount of regional aid we could give and the places we could give it to was determined by Brussels. And the only parts of the United Kingdom that qualified for aid under Brussels categorization were really the very fringes of the country, bits of Cornwall and so on, really quite remote places. So that gave an excuse to successive governments of both parties from the 1960s, from the 70s onwards, to say, well, we don't need to have a regional strategy. In fact, we can't even have a regional strategy because Brussels has ruled it out. So now that we're out of the European Union, this is the first government that's come to power saying we're going to have a strategy for the regions. We're going to brand it as levelling up. That's a slogan. We all know that's a slogan. But we're going to have a strategy for that. And I think that's astonishing. I mean, the last time this really happened was in the 60s under Harold Wilson, before we joined the European Union. Now, and that's an important reference. I'll come back to that if I may. But the first thing is to say, isn't it marvellous to have a government that really thinks this is an important problem and needs some solutions? The second thing is, what does levelling up consist of and how do you deliver it? And if you want to criticise the government, it's for not having, in my view, although it's produced this white paper, which is very good analytically, but then when it comes to the policies, it's not absolutely clear that they've got, as yet, a clear idea of what their regional strategy is going to be for improving incomes and opportunities and the cultural life and the cohesion of places outside London. Osborne and Cameron and people like that had quite good policies for major cities. So the Manchesters and the Birminghams and to some extent Leedses sort of got a lot of help and support and flourished to some extent. But all the smaller towns, all the smaller cities and the towns were sort of forgotten if they weren't immediately part of Manchester or whatever in the region. There was nothing for them. So what this government is trying to do is, for the first time, something for them. It's not clear what it's going to look like. And you can criticise the government over that. But then what I don't think you can criticise the government for is not delivering it immediately. Because very little of what a sustained rebalancing of the economy, very little of that could be delivered in a short space of time, and certainly not before the next general election. What you can do is start to lay the foundations and set a certain direction before the next general election, which is only whatever, 2 years away, or I don't know, maybe 2 years, whatever.
It does. I'm always curious to see what Conservatives think of the levelling up agenda, because from what I've read and from what I understand, and I'm not in Yorkshire, so I think that's a point to be made, is that it's really lovely intentions and it's really nice to say that regions should get investment and that the government from Westminster will be able to do it. but I've yet to see anything on the ground of actually bricks and mortar, a little bit more focused on those areas. And I'll be fascinated to see whether Boris can achieve this, because if he can, I think he's got the next general election in the bag. And I think if he can't, I don't know whether those people in North Yorkshire will vote for him.
Well, you can see some of it already in bricks and mortar, though not built. So, for example, I know this is a sensitive subject, not going ahead with the leg of HS2 that ran up the east side, the Leeds branch of HS2, not going ahead with that meant that the government could spend, could announce the spending of nearly £100 billion of rail investment across the north, which now you could argue about which is better value. Is it HS2, which would go very quickly but stop in only two or three places, so only serve two or three places, or is it a pattern of investing almost the same amount of money but across a lot more smaller projects that will serve a lot more people? You can argue about that, and I haven't looked at it sufficiently in detail to have that argument with you, but I know quite a lot. I used to do Transport for London for Boris. I know quite a lot of the rail people behind it are really convinced that this will be a much better way of spending the money than going ahead with HS2. But of course, when you say something like that's going to happen, it's not going to happen overnight. It takes a long time to do anything on the railways. And of course, there's disruption involved whenever you do. So you have to spread, even if you could do it quickly, you'd still have to spread it out over quite a long time, or people would murder you for closing down their trains for months on end while you rebuild the railway, and so on. So the sort of that sort of thing, I think, is really important. And there is private sector. What I think the government has to do, because the government can never do all this on its own, it has to make the regions more attractive as a destination for private sector investment. And there's an idea that free ports could help with this. But I think a general loosening of a reduction of taxation and an improvement in business incentives would probably be just as effective, or if not more effective. But it's things like that that can start to attract more private sector investment, and ideally in jobs that are jobs with a future and that have got skills to them, rather than in just sort of, I don't know, jobs that are low paid jobs and attract people for short periods with little career development.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating listening to what you have to say. It is very interesting hearing a different perspective on the news events, because obviously on our podcast, we're unashamedly biased towards the left. That is who we are. That's what we do. But obviously it's nice to hear the other side of the argument and to kind of connect where I think our arguments overlap in terms of concern with, particularly on levelling up, concern with implementation and how things are actually going to improve for ordinary people on the ground. And it is quite nice to hear that from a different perspective.
Well, thank you very much, Brandon. Thank you, Kathleen.
Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. A special thank you to Lord Moylan for coming on this podcast at such short notice and rescheduling. We'll be back next week with a Whinging Wednesday in a more recognisable style that you're used to.
If you enjoyed listening to us, please subscribe to this podcast to be notified of when new episodes come out. We also have a mailing list, the Left Whingers Community, which you can join by using the link in this episode's description. Likewise, you can keep in touch with us using the links to our social media, which are also in our description.
Squash the beef, go to Yorkshire, keep whinging, and we'll see you soon.